This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Illinois State University is setting up a coronavirus testing lab.
The goal is to get several thousand, so hopefully up to 10,000 per day.
The Shield Illinois facility will cover one of 11 regions around the state. Plus, human resource administrators are having a tough time navigating the many needs employees have during the pandemic, keeping the humane in human resources. ISU student athletes are not happy with University Athletic Director Larry Lyons' flip remark that all Redbird lives matter. And State Senator Jason Berrickman says the energy policy debate opened up by last week's announcement two Illinois nuclear reactors will close is a really complicated one. All that and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from WGLT listeners. Join the community of informed news consumers who listen to WGLT and also support it financially. Learn more about how you can support WGLT's nonprofit public service mission at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. McLean County's COVID-19 testing positivity rate ticked up again today as Illinois State University reported 39 more cases among its students. Illinois Wesleyan added 6 more. The positivity rate is now 10.3%, a new record that will likely soon bump McLean County into the state's warning level status. That doesn't automatically trigger new state mitigations, but is meant to get the attention of local leaders. A Pekin doctor who fought off and recovered from COVID-19 says it's important to continue taking the virus seriously. Dr. Tom Luft contracted the virus in June and was hospitalized when he had difficulty breathing. He says it's important not to let up on precautions now that the stay-at-home orders are lifted.
One of the things that I quickly had learned from this is that we should have that diligence like we all had in the beginning. It's something that, I think we need to all fight that pandemic fatigue and do take it seriously.
Luft says he is treating far more patients with COVID-like symptoms now than earlier this summer when the cases were few and far between. McLean County Health Department Administrator Jessica McKnight says the county's COVID data show smaller communities are not immune from coronavirus outbreaks. Two of the three highest rates of infection in McLean County are in small towns, Bellflower and Hudson.
The virus is here, and so every interaction with someone outside of your household, whether you be in an urban area, a rural area, we're seeing COVID-19 everywhere.
McKnight says most of the cases in rural communities are from known exposures, such as work or from within a household. Normal has the second highest infection rate per 1,000 residents. Two Bloomington zip codes rank fourth and fifth. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM, WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University will create a lab to do saliva-based coronavirus testing to more quickly detect positive cases and control outbreaks during this pandemic. It's part of the 11-region Shield Illinois program run out of the University of Illinois Innovation Center. The U of I developed the test that will be used. John Bauer is a chemistry professor and ISU's COVID-19 testing coordinator. He says it will take a while for the lab to be ready.
It is looking like it's probably 8 to 10 weeks away because of all the setup we have to do, and we have to do some hiring of staff as well.
How complex is the testing? What know-how and what supplies do you have to have?
So the testing itself is pretty straightforward. You collect the saliva and it gets heat and activated, so you heat it in a water bath for a while. And then you extract, or you run it through the PCR instrument, which looks for the viral DNA or the viral RNA, I think. The testing process itself is pretty simple. It's the logistics of handling several thousand samples a day, which requires some fairly sophisticated solution handling equipment so that you make sure you track the samples all the way through the process. The other complication is that this is all regulated, right? So you have to have a CLIA certified lab.
Where would ISU put this lab?
We were planning to locate it in the science lab building, so we hope to be speccing that out and making sure that it will meet all the requirements.
What kind of space and staff size are you talking about?
hopefully it'll just be one lab that is the size of a teaching lab, large enough that will hold probably 8 to 10 workstations. And we expect having 1 to 2 shifts of about 6 employees each shift doing the testing.
How much capacity would the lab have on a per day test number?
The goal is to get several thousand, so hopefully up to 10,000 per day. And that's where the Shield Illinois program is shooting for their lab capacities.
The U of I is testing, 30,000 people a week, or more than that even? What would ISU's target be, and how often do you test any particular student?
Yeah, so we're still having those discussions and looking at the model. We expect that we will offer the test at least once a week, depending on capacity and how we get up and running. We may go to two per week. That's still under discussion.
What's the difference between once a week or twice a week in the ability to contain an outbreak and identify people who have it and their immediate contacts?
Sure. Of course, the more often you do the testing, the quicker you'll catch outbreaks. The U of I model, they show that they get the best results with face coverings and with twice a week testing. One of the key things that's important about this saliva-based test is that the results can be produced much quicker. And so there's some discussion about whether that offsets the need for twice a week or whether we can do once per week, because that's obviously a significant difference in cost, but we definitely want to do what's the safest for the community.
ISU would be a main customer for this lab. Would other community stakeholders also be customers?
Yes, that's the plan. Part of the Shield Illinois system is that different community partners would have access to the testing capabilities, and I think they have people that are reaching out to community organizations to see if they'll be interested in testing through our site.
Which organizations?
I'm not familiar with exactly who they've been talking to, but I assume it's the major employers and the other universities in town. That's one of the goals of the Shield program, is to make it available as widely as possible.
Retirement communities or nursing homes, extended care facilities that have to test their staff?
Yes, I'm sure that I would expect that they're reaching out to them as well.
Even at 10,000, it sounds like there will be enough demand to take up that capacity.
Yeah, that's the fortunate or unfortunate thing, is that there is a lot of demand. And so, you know, the higher capacity we have, the more we can do to test and make sure that we do as much testing as possible throughout the community.
Cornell has a test. Yale has a test. There's both saliva-based. Another place has something that would be similar to a pregnancy test, where you actually just spit on cardboard and it turns up, although that may not be quite ready for market. What are the differences in all of these?
Many of them are similar. So the saliva-based, PCR-based test that Cornell and Yale have uses a very similar technique to the U of I method. The advantage of us using that is that U of I has the system that they can share with us, and we can implement their system because they've done the study to say that it's equivalent to the Yale method. Much of the like card tests are what are called antigen tests. So they're a type of test that detects some of the proteins in the virus, but not the genetic material. And so they tend to give you quicker results. They're easier to use, but they're less specific. They're not confirmatory. Typically, if those turn positive, you have to back it up with one of these genetic methods.
President Dietz has said that the U of I tests are going to be about $2 a pop, but if you're running 10,000 up to 10,000 a day, that's still a pretty chunk of change. How's this going to be paid for?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Each of the community organizations that are going to run tests will have to pay for their tests. So say if a long-term care facility wants to do some testing, they'll pay a per test amount that goes into the running of the lab. We as ISU will also have to pay a per test price. If we did everybody on campus twice a week, it gets very expensive.
Illinois State University COVID-19 testing coordinator and chemistry professor John Bauer says the lab will cost close to $1 million to set up. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. still to come, putting the humane in human resources. That's from Ryan Denham in just a few more minutes. Student athletes at Illinois State University have staged a boycott after athletics director Larry Lyons said all Redbird lives matter during a video call with student athletes, coaches, and administrators. Student athletes say Lyons' apology seemed insincere. They've developed a list of demands to address what they say is systemic racism in ISU athletics. Kimathi Johnson is a senior track athlete at ISU. He tells Eric Stock the problem goes beyond what Lyons said. It's also what he hasn't said.
To claim that all Redbird lives matter in his statement, I think maybe would not have blown up as much if the administration had represented Black Lives Matter in the past, right? If they had publicly, not only publicly supported, but then also supported its athletes, specifically Black athletes. We didn't have a meeting, you know, for all of the people who have been killed from violence on, from cops against Black people or any hate crime against Black people over the past few months. We haven't had any meetings, any calls, any, not even a message or an email from the administration saying, hey, are, you know, is there any way we can support Black athletes? Is there, you know, their counseling services? Nothing like that. And so I think a lot of it comes from what he did not say. He, you know, did not say Black Lives Matter. He did choose to say all lives matter. For us, it was a lot of he failed and the administration failed to support the Black Lives Matter movement, but any other social justice movement. We've never had any sort of meetings or education about Pride over Pride Month. We haven't really had much about meetings about sexual assault or Me Too, or when, you know, a case does come out at another college or somewhere in the U.S., there isn't much outward support from the administration for the women on our teams. So I think to even say all Redbird lives matter was a lie, but then also in response to Black Lives Matter.
Would you say that this was out of misunderstanding? Was it out of ignorance? Is it out of racism? How would you characterize that statement being made in this time in our country?
Well, I think I can't speak for Larry. However, I will speak to, if it was out of ignorance, ignorance is racism. If you, especially as a 64-year-old man, who is supposed to represent Black athletes, women, LGBTQ people, if you're supposed to represent Black athletes during a Black Lives Matter movement happening in America, then it is your duty, it is your job to learn about Black Lives Matter, to learn about your athletes. You can't claim ignorance in a situation like that. And if you do claim ignorance, it is still racism. If you are ignorant about the issues that are plaguing your students and you're ignorant about the world, you are choosing to be racist. Unfortunately, Black people cannot choose to be ignorant about racism. You know, we don't have a choice because we experience it every day. We see it in the world every day. We notice it even when maybe it's not there, but we are trained to look for it, to be on guard all the time. So we can't be ignorant.
Take me through your thought process and how you decided to respond.
For me, I mean, I can kind of deal with my pain personally, and I knew something was wrong outside of just the normal, like, someone hurting me. But it wasn't until I saw, like, okay, my teammates are also feeling this, that it felt like it was my job as a captain. And I think all the captains felt this. It was our job as captains to do something. Like, we couldn't just sit there. And so that was kind of the first step, was that meeting, along with our coaches as well, who all support us, that meeting with our coaches and our captains, we realized, like, okay, now is the time for action. Like, you know, this has been something that's been going on for a long time. Now is our time to take a step forward.
So what was the next step in getting Larry Lyons and administration re-engaged to have him address this?
We needed action because this had been going on for so long. And so when we got in the meeting with him, and it was me and a couple of the other captains, that was the next step. And it just didn't feel sincere, the apology he gave us. And I don't think the one on Friday felt very sincere from all the athletes I've talked about and me personally. And so that was kind of the first step in the movement, was trying to gauge, was the administration, did they understand what they did is wrong, and did they understand how wrong it was and how much it hurt the athletes, and that it was going to require them to change and move forward as an administration, as opposed to just apologizing and trying to get back to the norm.
So they felt that it was just simply the wrong use of words. To apologize removes it, and let's all move on.
Yes, that is what it felt like to us in the meetings, and that's what it seemed to be, since they hadn't, I mean, it did not seem like from any of the meetings we had that they had made a decision to change or made a plan to move forward. And that was kind of why that was one of our primary demands, was they need to make a public plan about what they're going to do next, what they're going to change, so that they can be held accountable for it, because it didn't seem like that was their original plan. It felt a lot like their plan was damage control.
That is ISU senior runner Kimadi Johnson with Eric's talk. ISU Athletics posted an action plan for social change on its website this afternoon. The department says it is committed to responding to the list of demands from student athletes. The phrase "Black Lives Matter" was in all caps. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a talk with a state senator from Bloomington about energy policy. The pandemic has thrust employers and their workers into all sorts of new uncomfortable conversations about childcare, medical privacy, and work-from-home arrangements. Stuck in the middle are human resource professionals like Ashley Cunningham and Sam Lewis. Cunningham is the HR manager at Four Seasons Health Club in Bloomington. Lewis owns the staffing and recruiting agency Pride Staff. They're both leaders with the Bloomington Normal Human Resource Council, and spoke to Brian Denham about the increasingly tricky balance that's now a part of their everyday work.
Trying to help our employees the best we can, because we have employees that have kids going through the same thing that I am as a parent. And so how can we help support them so that they can feel like they can work and be a parent slash teacher slash whatever else they're having to be right now?
You know, I kind of think of this thing like, the Army War College, they teach that VUCA thing, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. HR is dealing in VUCA today. With HR, you know, this is HR's time. If we're not in the game at the table, helping with businesses get through this effectively and efficiently in a profitable manner, then we probably don't have a place at all.
What are some of the other biggest challenges facing HR professionals and HR departments right now?
I think it's kind of like in two, HR people right now kind of divided in kind of two groups. There's the HR people that are having to deal with this whole workforce at home, remote, and then there's HR people that I work with my business that are dealing with workers coming to work. Are they taking temperatures as employees come to work at the work site, taking temperatures, and what's your protocols if someone gets a fever? Just as a whole myriad of things that are you have to think about now that you didn't think about at the beginning of March.
Having employees wearing masks and taking temperatures and doing health screenings and all of the safety precautions that you're putting into place every day to try and keep your staff healthy and make sure that they can come to work, especially if you're in an industry like the one that I'm in, where it's a service-oriented type of industry. So we can't just have everybody work from home. We need people to be there to help our customers and serve them. And so it's definitely difficult to try and manage, okay, who's working from home, who's able to be in the building, if somebody does get sick, trying to manage the scheduling around that.
Is there an argument that if you treat your employees sort of the right way during this unprecedented moment, that you might earn a bit of career loyalty, if that's even the right word, mm-hmm. that's sort of otherwise more difficult to come by?
They're almost in the situation where they have to be flexible with their staff, because we don't want to lose good people. You know, I'd rather be flexible with the people that we have and keep those good people than to have to start all over again. So yeah, I think that's a part of it as well. But I do feel like that loyalty does play a part of it, that if you can be flexible and supportive with your staff now, they're going to remember that, and they're going to be more engaged and more supportive to the organization long term.
Another new part of the job for HR professionals, I would think, would be when an employee does test positive and you have to sort of walk them through what is required and what are the guidelines, what do you have to do next. What is your sense of how HR professionals are adjusting to that sort of new part of their job?
I am not, I'm not happy with the testing thing. You know, I think it's, if you have, we've had employees where we sent them for a test on Monday, and we don't know till like Friday or the next Monday what the results are. So when I say they can come back to work if they've got a negative on Monday, all I know on Friday is that they were negative on Monday. That's all I know. You know, did they really quarantine from Monday to Friday waiting to find out? And I don't know if Ashley's had to deal with any of this yet, but it's frustrating for me. And I'll say that if we had just like widespread rapid results testing in 4 weeks, I'm like a big prediction, in 4 weeks, we would be almost done with this COVID thing.
What are the pressures that HR departments and HR professionals are under to make sure you're telling other employees what they need to know, but not saying so much that you put someone's privacy at risk?
So based on my experience, obviously, yeah, you can't share specifics about the person, unfortunately. And I know people want to know, okay, well, what is my exposure? But we can't share that information. So really what we have been able to provide is kind of a time frame. So maybe it was a specific day and a specific range of hours that this person was in the facility, or, you know, that sort of information. That way it gives people, okay, so if I would have been at the club at that time on that day, maybe monitor symptoms or, you know, things like that. But again, yeah, there's only so much that we can say. And I know it's unfortunate we're not able to provide more information, but we want to keep that person's information as confidential as we possibly can.
Do other employees ever get frustrated? Like, I wish we could know more about what happened, and you have to sort of face that and just say, I'm sorry, yeah. That's where we are.
They do, and they ask a lot of questions. And unfortunately, all we can say is, you know, I'm sorry, I'm unable to share that with you. This is what I am able to share with you at this time. And that's really all we can do. And there are probably times where they'll figure it out on their own just because of the situation. But, you know, that's, if they do that, you know, that's fine, but we're not able to share information more than what we're able to.
That's Ashley Cunningham and Sam Lewis from the Bloomington Normal Human Resource Council speaking with Ryan Denham. This is Sound Ideas on Bloomington Normal's public media, WGLT and WGLT.org. Last week, Commonwealth Edison announced it would close the Byron 1 and 2 nuclear reactors in northern Illinois. The nuclear subsidiary Exelon says those are not profitable. The announcement is reminiscent of a company statement some years ago announcing a similar closure at the Clinton nuclear power plant. That didn't happen because lawmakers put together a package to make nuclear plants more economical to operate. State Senator Jason Berrickman is a Republican member of one of the energy policy committees in Springfield that deals with those issues this time around.
I know that there's been some speculation that Exelon is using this announcement as a negotiating ploy, and I'm sure that to some degree that's true. I mean, I read their announcement. Their announcement said that they're planning to close, but they're going to continue to, you know, have discussions with lawmakers in the governor's office. My approach is I take their threat very seriously. Obviously, it could have a tremendous impact on the economy. It could displace many jobs. But it also, I think, another important component is the impact those closures could have on our state's energy policy, the availability of, you know, different types of energy. And it's a really complex discussion and debate that we'll have.
Are there pitfalls in that?
I worry that there are some advocates in the debate who have an agenda that could really cripple one of the great things that we have in Illinois, which is a strong energy policy. We've gone through just in recent weeks, you know, some tremendous weather that has caused some very short-term outages, but nothing compared to what you've seen in other states where they don't have the stability in their energy grid as we do in Illinois. I simply want to make sure that we don't take something that is good and stable and predictable and break it as we make these changes.
Past packages that have addressed the competitiveness of Illinois' nuclear fleet have included apportioning some dollars for green jobs in addition to helping Exelon's bottom line and making sure that the economic development part of the nuclear reactors is addressed in given regions. How do you see a way forward on this one? Is it going to be more investment in green jobs to offset the help to Exelon, or are there other factors that need to be addressed?
You know, I think it's too soon to say. I'm certain the governor, you know, you look at all of the legislation that's been passed under the Pritzker administration, And one of the things that he campaigned on that remains on the sidelines is some significant shift in energy policy. So I think his supporters are clamoring for some movement in legislation. He, of course, put out recently some principles guiding, you know, bullet points of what he wants to see in changes in the law. I certainly think that he will be an advocate for more investment in, support in green energy. What that looks like and what the trades are to get there are unclear. I think there's lots of members on both sides of the aisle who believe that, you know, clean energy is important, an important public policy. But you have to look at it holistically and ask yourself as you're trying to achieve policy goals, whether you're creating negativity or unintended consequences that could actually hurt the overall energy strategy for the state. And so where we go, it's just too soon to say.
State Senator Jason Berrickman is a Bloomington Republican. Another complicating factor in the looming energy policy debate is Commonwealth Edison's place in a far-flung federal corruption investigation involving lobbying. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Eric Stock and Ryan Denham. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or NPR One. This is WGLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.